I'm Bill Radke, and you are tuned in to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. That's what we do here every day. We're bringing you the news, and the big news today is that Washington State is still challenging President Trump's travel ban. The Attorney General of this state, Bob Ferguson, you may remember he won a restraining order in court against President Trump's first travel ban. Today, just a little bit ago today, Ferguson asked a federal judge to extend that order. He said it still applies to this revised ban that Trump released this week. We have KUOW's immigration reporter Ruby DeLuna. Now, she was at the Attorney General's news conference in downtown Seattle. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, Bill.
What is Attorney General Ferguson's argument for extending this block on the travel ban?
Well, basically, new order, same concerns. The two particular provisions of the order in particular are a concern. It bans refugees from entering the country, and it also bans people from the six Muslim countries from entering the country. And so, you know, those are the same, they're basically repackaged, but it still raises the same concerns from the previous executive order.
Yes. So he's asking the judge to keep that injunction in place, keep the revised travel ban from kicking in. So this is not really a new lawsuit then announced today.
No, not at all. It's the same lawsuit, same constitutional problems. And as A.G. Ferguson said, just because the new order is new, it's repackaged, it still has the same constitutional problems.
The president does not get to decide if a new executive order is different enough to be clear from that underlying injunction. The court decides that, not the president. The court decides. So one way to think about this, if you maybe excuse the example a little bit, is it cannot be a game of whack-a-mole for the court.
No game of whack-a-mole. Okay, so Ruby, before Washington State can even argue over constitutionality, the state's got to show that we are damaged even by this scaled-down travel ban. So how does Attorney General Ferguson say that our state is still harmed?
That's right. This is more than just an abstract question or a constitutional question. There are harms. There are practical realities or effects that this new order is creating or could create. It's the same thing as we've seen last time, which is students who may have been admitted to the universities, like UW, for example, still can't come to the states to come and study. Businesses can't hire from overseas or have its employees travel freely. And it still means that some families cannot be reunited with their loved ones. So these are real consequences.
Yes, that is Attorney General Bob Ferguson's claim that Washington State would be harmed and has standing to continue to extend this court challenge. That's KUOW's Ruby DeLuna, who was at that news conference. Ruby, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
And KUOW reached Mark Krikorian this morning from the Center for Immigration Studies, and he says,
the president does not need the court's permission here. Congress has given the president blanket authority to keep out any person or any class of persons that he thinks it's important to keep out.
So obviously the Center for Immigration Studies is supporting President Trump's revised travel ban. Mark Krikorian says this is not a Muslim ban.
Even if it were a Muslim ban, it would be legal. There may be political reasons to be against it, and if the president does something dumb, he can pay a political price for it. That's the way things work. But judges have no legal right to interfere in these questions, because if this precedent stands, essentially the American people will no longer have the authority to decide who gets to come in and who is kept out of their own country.
Again, today's news, Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson is asking that federal judge to continue this temporary restraining order against the President Trump's, even the revised travel ban. You're listening to KUOW 94.9 Seattle. We'll surely follow together how that legal challenge plays out. Meanwhile, let's talk about one of the countries that is on President Trump's travel ban list, and that is Somalia. If you talk to some Somali families in Seattle, you're going to find that many of them came here as refugees. That is a process that can take years. The Trump administration's travel ban will also put the nation's refugee program on hold temporarily while the rigor of the vetting is assessed and maybe strengthened. But as KUOW's Kate Walters found out, refugees hoping to come to America already face surprising obstacles.
Let me take you back to March 2015. In the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya, a family finds out they've been approved to immigrate to the U.S.
I was very happy, very happy. There was a lot of celebration and jubilation in my family. Yes, and we invited some colleagues to eat with us because they were also very happy. We got the approval of USA.
That's Mohammed Rashid. He was approved to take his wife and two young daughters to Seattle. His brother and brother-in-law were approved to move as well. After more than two decades in Dadaab and more than 4 years in the resettlement process, they were finally getting a new life, a better life. And then something happened that set the brothers on very different paths. Rashid's wife became pregnant. Months later, when two brothers boarded the plane to Seattle, Rashid and his family had to stay behind in the camp.
We were approved, but they want now to approve the child.
The baby was born in November 2015. Rashid and his family are still waiting for the infant to be approved.
Unless Department of Homeland Security, they see the baby cannot travel. Like, you know, Australia and Sweden and UK is very good. Automatically, when you have the baby, they add.
Some other countries don't require babies to be vetted. But US officials say the law requires all members of any family are seen in person by a Homeland Security officer, including babies. They say newborn babies are no exception, in part to prevent fraud and child trafficking. A situation like Rashid's is not uncommon. But that doesn't mean it's not frustrating. Rashid takes me to meet his family. His home is one of the nicest in the camp. It's a proper structure instead of a tent. And even though his fence, like all the others, is made from braided twigs, he has a real gate with a sliding bolt.
This is the baby.
His pride is evident as he scoops up his son. He's worth the delay in the case, Rashid says. But he's still determined to take his family to Seattle. He rattles off what he's been told about the Emerald City.
Seattle is a good city. It's where we where I like to go. It's a good place. The climate is okay, I was told. Just, you know, the weather is not very harsh. Though I was told it has a lot of rain.
It seems the old stereotypes dog Seattle even halfway across the world. But it doesn't bother Rashid. He wants to see his brothers.
Even my children are asking me, where is our uncle? Where has he gone? Will he come tomorrow? I told them, your uncle has gone very far. But you will join in the future, if God says.
Hi, Tanada.
Back in the Seattle area, Rashid's brother-in-law is desperate for the family to join him. When Tanad Surat first came to the US, he thought the rest of his family was right behind him. 18 months later, he's alone.
Sometimes I'm crying because I'm living alone here. Oh my gosh. Sometimes I say, I don't need to be here. I like to go back to Africa, but I can't go back to Africa.
Surat feels like he needs to stay to help support his family in the camp. But that's a lot of pressure, and he's had to put his education and personal life on hold. He wants his family to be together, but it's unlikely that the baby will be seen before the Trump administration's travel ban goes into effect. And once the ban starts, no one knows how long the family's case could be on hold.
I don't like it, that rule. If you say nobody coming here, I need to go back to Africa. I don't need to be here anymore.
While the family waits to find out whether or not they'll be allowed into the US, the baby that caused their delay continues to grow up fast. From Dadaab Refugee Camp, Kenya, I'm Kate Walters, KUOW News.
To hear more of our series, In Limbo, just go to KUOW.org. It's listener-supported KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. President Trump has removed federal protections allowing students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that reflect their gender identities. Well, here in Washington State, that doesn't have any legal impact, at least not yet. We have our own statewide law that allows students to make those decisions. My next guests are following all of this closely. Layla Gaysar and Fred Annex Schnaus are trans teens going to school here in King County. They say even with state protections in place, it's never been easy for them to use the bathroom or locker room at school. Fred told me what that looks like.
when I was in high school, before I switched into doing the Running Start program, I was a lot more involved in school athletics. And that meant that every day I was changing at school. And we didn't have all gender bathrooms. So the nurse's office bathroom was the one that I was told that I was allowed to use. And that means walking through the nurse's office, often when they're with a patient, going in there to use the bathroom. And there was a lot of gatekeeping in my daily life when I just needed to go to the bathroom. And the same thing with sports. I wasn't always able to access the playing field because I didn't have a place to change, or I wasn't able to go to the bathroom before a big meet. And just really basic things like that. I've noticed that myself and a lot of other transgender people, like, regardless of what the law books are saying, every single time that I need to pee, I will be doing calculations to figure out where I can safest do that and where I cannot make other people feel uncomfortable, and like how far I can walk across the campus before I'm missing half my class to go to the bathroom.
You mentioned confrontations, Fred. Can you give us a typical example of what kind of confrontation happens?
The most typical is someone looking at me and being like, "You're in the wrong place." But more often than not, there's weird looks. Sometimes people will come up really close to me and try to figure out maybe like what my body is, when that absolutely has nothing to do with going to the bathroom. And sometimes, like, there have been people who stand facing me in the bathroom and ask, like, "What are you doing here? Why are you here? And what is the easiest way that I can get you out of here?" and threaten violence.
Will you explain what you mean by going to the bathroom having nothing to do with them wanting to know about your body? Because first blush, they're thinking that the two have everything to do with each other.
Yeah, I think that this whole discussion of bathrooms is often about transgender people's bodies. But it is more about, like, we can figure out where we're going to be able to go to the bathroom. And it's more about other people having that curiosity. That kind of part of a lot of discussions about people being transgender is that curiosity and entitlement to knowing what my genitals are and what's under my shirt. And that's just simply not something that any other demographic of teenager is generally asked when they need to pee.
Layla, what's your take on the bathroom locker room experience?
With my own experiences, before I even enter the bathroom, I've often been asked, "Which bathroom do you use?" And while this seems like an innocent question, it's often it's kind of dog whistle for, "What's your genitalia? How can I like gender you in my mind so I can understand?
What are you?" That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Once you know, I also get with race. What are you? What are you actually?
You have an Iranian background.
Yeah. And when I enter the bathroom, I've been confronted in both male and female bathrooms. I recently, in the past year, I gained a lot of weight, but before then, I very much actually passed for a cisgender male. And so when I would go into female bathrooms, often I would get asked, "What are you doing here? Get out." Now I kind of just don't care. I'm privileged in that way, I think, to not care, since I live in a very liberal city.
You've both been gracious to talk about bathrooms and locker rooms, the subject of many initiatives and pronouncements. What do you want to say about the modern trans non-binary experience that is important? Fred?
I think that some of the most pressing things that need to be addressed right now are looking at LGBT youth homelessness and looking at the high murder rates of transgender people and the amount of like grief that's in our communities. It's not being talked about, not being addressed. And every single year for the Transgender Day of Remembrance for the last like 4 or 5 years, I've compiled the statistics, and it's alarming. About 300 transgender women a year are killed in the U.S. and many more than that in the whole world. And I think that there's a lot more intersections and complexity that need to be looked at to understand how race and ability and police and all of these things are playing into the large amount of harm that's being done.
Often when people talk about violence against trans people, they often ignore the fact that it is almost entirely towards Black and Latina trans women of color. And so I think recognizing that that is a problem, and recognizing that race and misogyny do have a part to play in trans hate crimes, is a big step, because I often see, you know, white trans men dominating discussions about transphobia, which is not the most productive thing, because statistically they are not the primary targets and they are not the people that are being actively murdered.
Anything to add, Fred, about this problem of race and gender identity?
Yeah, I think that Layla said it wonderfully. Like, looking at base in Seattle, like you mentioned Seattle earlier, looking at queer spaces and transgender spaces, like it already comes up as an issue. There's a lot of racism in the community and a lot of lack of spaces and lack of spaces where we can all be together because of racism in our community. And looking at all the complex issues and the like multitude of things that the transgender community is facing, there is no way to deny that racism plays into it. Racism and transmisogyny are like primary things that are causing harm to the transgender community as a whole.
Some people might be surprised to hear that racism would be a problem in the trans community, because there's this idea of, oh, if anybody could be able to accept differences. And you're kind of rolling your eyes. What's your take?
There's often this thing that I've seen happen, especially in Seattle, where people like check off the inclusion box by being like, I have an identity that's marginalized, and now I can't marginalize other people. But that's just simply not true.
What's your take, Layla?
I have talked with many other trans people of color, and it is definitely a problem. I think that people view the trans community as accepting or possibly can't comprehend the idea of a trans person of color is because the face of trans people in the media is often white. And of course, we as a population don't generally see many intersections of identity in the media. For example, like a lot of people don't know that like you can be gay and trans and a person of color and disabled, etc. And so people don't understand how privilege can work in different ways, like Fred said.
You've gotten to know one another a little bit through this conversation. Are there any questions that you have for one another that are not my questions?
You seem to have quite a bit more experience with LGBT plus spaces than I do. What are the pros and cons to often being in spaces that are primarily LGBT?
Fred, will you give examples of what spaces we're talking about so everybody knows?
Yeah, I'm involved with a LGBTQ youth summer camp, and I do some work for a Equity Resource Center, and I've done some other panel type peer education things. And in all of those communities, some of the themes that I see are that kind of the way we've been talking this whole time, but that identity checkbox, being in community with people can be really challenging when we're thinking about people as checkboxes. And I also think that ageism is a big part of what I've experienced. Youth don't have access to a lot of the spaces that transgender people are allowed to be in as a community and allowed to find shared identity in. And so I think that one thing that I'd really like to see in our communities is to be able to think about how youth are powerful and know a lot and have a lot of different experiences and lenses for the world that are just untapped. And there's a lot of things that we can learn from each other.
Layla, do you have any sense of a direction that we're going with trans issues in this country?
I don't know what's going to happen in the next few years. I do think we are a very resilient community. We've put up with a lot in the past. We, you know, this isn't our like first time in the rodeo, some would say, but I do think it's not going to be easy. Recognizing that is like the first step to staying strong.
I always have been an optimist. I would love to think that in the future we'll learn to listen to each other and we'll learn how to hold each other better in community. But in the short term, I'm not sure what's going to happen. And I think that this unsurety is one of the hardest things to sit with. I would love to see change and to see people stop policing transgender bodies and trans lives and to remember that we've always existed. And will continue to exist. And I agree with what Layla said, like resiliency is something that gives me a lot of hope. As a trans youth, a lot of what I saw and what I learned was that I was supposed to be tragic and I was supposed to have a tragic story and see my life expectancy as no later than 25 and expect violence and expect to be treated in a subhuman way. And I think that portraying our community as successful and complicated and lovely and surreal and all of the complex things that humans are gives a lot more space for hope and a lot more space for transgender youth to find ways to be successful and loved.
Leila Gaysar and Fred Anik Schnaus are non-binary trans teens from King County. You know, I mentioned that Washington State, by law, allows students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that reflect their gender identities. But there is a Washington State group gathering signatures right now for an initiative that would repeal that law. Now, time for another story from the Pacific Northwest. Our next guest moved to Black Diamond in southeast King County so her kids could have more room to play and have an uncrowded drive to the mountains. Well, now a massive development is coming to her town, 6,000 homes, doubling the size of Black Diamond. We've been reporting on the residents fighting that development. This guest, Jonna Thompson's not one of those residents. She told me there are real advantages for the town she loves from this development, even though the size of it gave her pause for a minute.
At first, I thought, wow, that it sounds like a lot of people and a lot of houses, but let's look at what it looks like. So I, you know, spent some time talking to the developer, and I've gone to the hearings, and I've gone to a lot of council meetings, and I've been informed more about what the development is going to look like, and it's not going to look as bad as some people want it you to imagine it. It's going to contain a lot of open space, a lot of trails, a lot of it's the developer is really trying to retain the what's beautiful about Black Diamond, which is lots of trees and open space and Mount Rainier views. So I've got a broader sense of this is going to be okay.
Are you receiving any money or other consideration from this developer?
That's a good question. No. No, I am not. You know what I do in Black Diamond? I'm a community volunteer. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I spend my time volunteering in the community. So I get to do really creative things with my time. Like, for example, the last thing I did was I co-chaired the bond campaign for the Edumclaw School District that got the money that is building the new Black Diamond Elementary, which is going to be beautiful. I'm really proud of that. So no, I don't get paid. I just pay attention to what's happening in Black Diamond.
Jonna, you seem to be excited about the possibilities of becoming a bigger town. What's wrong with being a teeny town?
Well, what's wrong right now in Black Diamond is that it's so small. 4,000 people is a very small number to be able to support our police department. And, you know, cities either grow or they die. And if Black Diamond doesn't grow to be able to support the police department and the fire services, as well as the water services, it's a burden to a small group of people to have to support a city. So when new residents come, they'll help share that load. And when I spoke with the businesses this fall, they were all eager for new customers so that they can survive. Businesses are a big part of the tax base that a city has that, again, funds the basic infrastructure of a city. It pays the employees. It pays the police department. So small is nice, but let's be realistic about the future of a small city. It's very difficult to survive. And Black Diamond, I don't want to see the city go away because it doesn't grow. I want to see it thrive into the future.
Do you think this master planned development in Black Diamond is going to look very different from the growth that, say, Maple Valley or Covington has seen, which has been more piece by piece?
Very different. What I love about the plan in Black Diamond is that there's a plan, is that there is they took a lot of time, the city and the developer, to come up with a plan that's one big plan that incorporates where the schools are going to be, where the parks are going to be, how the roads are going to get improved. And what you had in Maple Valley is a lot more smaller developments. And those small developments triggered less money going into this to the community for infrastructure upgrades and repairs. So less traffic improvements. And so what's going to happen in Black Diamond is an increase in improvements because there's one developer. And then what happened in Covington has been a whole lot of big boxes, which since there's plenty of big boxes right 20 minutes away, Black Diamond won't need to have those kinds of stores, but we'll be able to be available to have other kinds of businesses move in.
We've been reporting about the acrimony in town you know, people disagreeing over this development, well-meaning people disagreeing. What's your experience of what this development fight has done to the sense of community in your town?
Well, the fight's been going on for a long time. Yeah. The fight's been going on since the development really got approved in 2011. People were paying attention at that time and fighting at that time. And after that point, there was an organization that formed that was called Toward Responsible Development. And they actually fought the development through lawsuits, and they took it all the way to the Supreme Court in Washington State, and they lost. So yes, there's been a lot of negative, but although there's still pushback, that pushback is much smaller. I think that people right now want to work with the developer to get the most out of the developer as possible.
Jonna Thompson lives in Black Diamond, where KUOW's Region of Boom team has been reporting on that town's growth. And if you'd like a visual of how that planned development is going to fit into the town, we're tweeting out a link right now at KUOW. Listener-supported KUOW, I might add. This is the first day of our Spring Forward membership drive. Please contribute right now. Contribute, 206-543-9595 or KUOW.org. And thank you. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Here's a story you've heard before. Artists move into a cheap neighborhood. Hip coffee shops and boutiques open. Condo developments pop up. Rich people move in. Artists get pushed out. Surely that story must resonate with Seattle painter Jane Richlovsky. She was one of the artists who had to move out of the 619 Western Avenue warehouse so the State Department of Transportation could bring in the tunnel boring machine Bertha.
What was interesting was that DOT has to compensate businesses that they're evicting for a highway project. It's federal law, and there's money set aside for that. But that's not actually what made it in the paper. The story seemed to like tap this well of nostalgia and myth about these bohemians in their shivering in their ghettos and
you martyred
in their garrets for their art.
Yes,
and that was pretty much it. Stopped there, and it also was this nostalgia for place that people had. You know, people who hadn't set foot in the building for 20 years, if ever, we're like, no, we can't lose that, you know, which, you know, it happens when like a restaurant closes as well.
Right. You've nailed yeah. Seattle.
I think that's pretty universal.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, it was not the story that they were telling in the media. It was not the story that we were living. So it got after.
Well, what were you living?
Well, what I was living was filling out a lot of forms, talking to a lot of real estate brokers, looking at property, talking to contractors, figuring out how I could use my relocation money to build new studios. And I kind of wanted to game the system a little bit more by having, there was a bunch of us and a bunch of us that were all separate businesses, so we kind of coordinated the move and coordinated the remodel of this space that I'd found in order to kind of maximize our benefits. And so it was extremely what they call left brain thinking, but it was still a creative experience. I had to be very creative to do this in 6 weeks. So that was the reality I was living, was talking to a lot of bureaucrats and contractors and haranguing people left and right and figuring out budgets and stuff.
Okay, so Jane, you got some Bertha relocation money, but how much does this apply to other artists?
Exactly. So the principle applies, which is that, you know, we use the resources at hand. And that's something like that artists did to even end up in that building in the first place. It was an abandoned warehouse. Nobody wanted it. And somebody talked to the landlord and said, hey, can I rent this? And then they brought some more people in. And then, I mean, that's kind of where I cut my teeth in developing artist studios, because I took over leases for people and sublet to about 20 different people, and had the whole building was actually managed by like 7 different artists. We were master leaseholders. We were leasing from someone else, but we were all already in business as it was. So we were using available resources. So my point is that artists are very crafty about using available resources. Artists are crafty, but we do it with physical materials and found things in our work all the time. And so there's other resources out there. And this was a resource that just kind of fell in our lap.
So then if nobody knows resourcefulness like an artist, yes. Why is there this, I don't know, you didn't use the word whiny or I don't know, defeatist?
Whiny's okay, yeah.
But, you know, why?
Fatalistic.
What do you, fatalistic
yeah.
is a much better word. Yeah. Why do you think that artists are often so fatalistic about surviving in Seattle, the
right.
unaffordable Seattle?
Or anywhere.
Or anywhere.
Really.
Or anywhere.
I mean, the Lower East Side of New York.
Yes.
Like anywhere. I think it applies to a lot of things in their life relating to business. And that's that they have this received idea of, in order to be creative, you have to be bad at business and flighty and unpredictable. And we've been taught that that's somehow a precursor to creativity,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's like, well, Van Gogh was crazy. But it's like a lot of people were crazy that never painted.
Yes.
And a lot of people painted who were never crazy.
Yeah.
But we use that confirmation bias to say like, oh, look how flighty they are. They're an artist. And
right.
then you internalize that.
They're soulful.
Yeah, they're soulful. And you know, whatever. Lots of people are soulful. You know, we're people who happen to want to, I'm talking about visual artists here, but people who want to use it to make some cultural artifact is what sets us apart and want to do it full time. So maybe that's crazy, but not in the sense of raving mad crazy. But I think that there's this perception that like the inverse is true, that if you're good at these things, that you're not a real artist. And that fear goes really deep. And you worry about it in people's perception of you and that it's not good for your career. I mean, that's why you have people who, you know, a successful artist playing up that crazy mythic artist.
Yes. Otherwise, you're an operative, you're a sellout, or you're, right, you're a commercial.
Right.
Commercial,
and it's pretty recent. You know, it's a pretty recent prejudice, relatively speaking.
Yeah,
the idea of like art and money having to be separate, and you know, in the Renaissance, those guys didn't work for free. You know, all of the great masterworks of art that we know were done for as gigs. You know, they were patrons.
They
were commissioned.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's not we have to deal with the reality of money in our lives all the time anyway.
So then, dare I say struggling, Seattle artist to do? What's your advice?
I would say if you're in a situation that you like, figure out how to, then you're renting a studio, buy it. Number two.
That sounds easy, by the way. Buy it?
I have actually, there's people that have.
Okay.
And there's people that should have done it back in the 70s.
Right.
The people who are really nostalgic about those really cheap storefronts they had, I'm like, you know, that would have been the time to do that. But
yeah, but now you're telling people to buy Seattle real estate in 2017?
There's an artist-owned complex down at Georgetown that was started by an artist, Sam Ferrazzano, and he got some creative financing. There's a lot of Small Business Administration money that's out there. You band together with other artists, but also band together with people who know what they're doing in terms of real estate. And there's people that want to help. What I did was formed a partnership. So buying the building last year, had nothing to do with the DOT money. That was finding a developer to partner with. And his interest, Greg Smith from Urban Visions, his interest was that he owns real estate in the neighborhood, and there's people that want to move into it because of its character.
Mm.
So if you obliterate the character and all the tech people see are other tech people, then that's actually, you know, diminishes the value of it.
So there you're taking advantage of a public association we have with artists, that right that you're
right.
you're valuable.
We're valuable.
We love you.
Exactly. And we should know our value that way. And that value is actually quantified. I mean, I think we have to get more savvy to use that power and use that value.
That value.
And cash it in.
Yes.
Cash in on it. And that requires changing a lot of people's mindsets and changing the mindset that we're like this charity that has to be taken care of, but that we're actually actors and be like, and cash the check.
Do you have no fear that you're...
No fear, none.
That's wonderful. Congratulations.
Yeah, no,
do you have any insecurity or self-doubt about, have I gotten savvy in commercial? Let me put it this way. Do you ever wonder whether your commercial savvy has changed your art? And if so, would it be for the worse?
I definitely know that it does affect some people's perception of it.
Uh-huh.
That's an issue that there's nothing I can do about that.
You've gotten that from people?
No, I can just tell.
Really? What do you mean?
Well, then I'm asked to be on committees that have to do with real estate and business, and I'm not asked to be on committees that have to do with actual art, even though I've been showing in galleries for 20 years and have grants to my name and everything. I've gotten this other identity.
Yes.
It's more that I'm stuck in that identity than anything. And, you know, that's subtle. But the internal part, I think, is the more interesting one. And that's something that, sure, who doesn't have doubts and hesitations? You always have a lot of insecurities that you're not a real artist.
Yeah, right.
You know, there's almost everybody does. And so that's just yet another thread of that and another thing that feeds that when you're feeling down anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's that separate from any other kind of insecurity, frankly.
And what about just the amount of time you end up spending being in business instead of creating?
Yes. Exactly. That's been an issue, but I think of right now, I mean, and you are anyway, if you're an artist and you're a working artist, you have to devote, you know, almost half your time to the business side of it anyway, depending on, you know, where you're at in your career. So that's a given. But this, what I'm doing now, this more this advocacy, I think of it as more as community work. And it, I also think of it as something that will pay off in the end. It's already paid off in the fact that I didn't have to move from my studio, from this studio, and I probably won't have to. And that's a lot of energy and time that I'm saving that way. So there's that. But there is, it's definitely, the hours in the day is an issue. The hours in the day is a big issue, but I feel like we're at this crisis point and I want to do something about it. I don't want to just sit there and whine.
If you're listening, if you're not an artist, but you're in the city, do you care what decisions, what creative business decisions your city's artists make?
Well, I can talk from my own experience in my own neighborhood that it, I think it does make a difference that you walk down the street and you run into people on a regular basis who have decided to devote their lives to making something beautiful. You know, whatever, that sounds sentimental or something, but it's really true. Like, that's what we do. And we've made a sacrifice to do that. But I don't want to focus on the sacrifice. I want to focus on what it is we're actually trying to do. And I think that the reason that, like, urban planners want us around in the beginning is we're on the, you know, we're eyes on the street. We do funky things. We paint murals or whatever. All that stuff that they want to expect younger artists to do for free.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, let's take that and be like, well, if you actually have people in the neighborhood that are established artists and you pay them, maybe they will make a beautiful piece of public art that actually has something that's organic to that neighborhood. That's one example. What we're going to do outside of our building is put in one of those parklet things.
Yep.
And we'll have art classes there. We can be out there sketching. People can join us. I mean, it's not going to be 24/7 because obviously we have to work, but we can add a little bit of that element to people's daily lives.
Seattle artist Jane Richlovsky has been painting narrative works on patterned textiles for almost 20 years and making a living at her art. She owns an artist studio building in Pioneer Square. You can hear more from Jane if you're on Whidbey Island tomorrow, because she's giving a talk for Humanities Washington at the Langley Library on Whidbey tomorrow at 6:30. That talk is titled, When Artists Get Together, They Talk About Real Estate. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. You know, yesterday on KUOW, we brought you Voices of Feminism on International Women's Day. As part of that event, women were encouraged to stay home from work to show the impact of women on the economy and or to wear something red. We asked you on Facebook if you participated. Beth says, I wish we could all take the day off to make a point, but it seems we're just not selfish enough to shut down the country. And not wealthy enough to afford even one day without pay. Chelsea says, we work at a very small library and there's only one man on our staff. Had women not come into work, the majority of the libraries in our system would have been closed. Serving our customers was more important to me, but I hope they took notice of all the red our staff was wearing. You'll find more comments on KUOW's Facebook page.